Philip Morgan, how are you, my friend?
Fucking 10 out of 10. How are you listening?
Oh, man. An F-bomb right off the bat. I love it. Okay, we are ready today for the offline podcast starring effing Philip Morgan. I'm good, man. I'm good.
Okay, good.
So, Philip, I wanted to say one thing, which is I hear from more and more people that they like the offline podcast, which is slightly shocking to me, but people are listening, Philip.
I hear the same thing, and it's made me willing to break the cone of silence and maybe, not just maybe, I think definitely I'm going to promote this. You and I were talking about, I know, yeah, the big.
This is a major milestone in our relationship, by the way.
It is, right. I feel like, okay.
You're going to take our relationship public, finally. I've been waiting for this day.
I'm updating my Facebook status. Yeah, I just love these conversations, and they're, I don't feel like off-brand, but there's like a different facet of both of us.
Yeah, I agree.
I've always been like, how would my main list react to this? But yeah, I'm going to start promoting these because I think more folks need to listen in and hear this.
Well, I can tell you for a fact, some people on your list are already listening because I hear from them occasionally. So that's already happening. So awesome.
Oh, wait, hold up. Hold up. Let me ask you this. Very few people who listen to my podcast ever communicate with me about my podcast.
Uh-huh.
I know maybe you don't listen to my podcast, but I feel like maybe I'm giving off some aura of like, leave me alone. And I don't mean to do that because I really do want to hear from podcast listeners.
Uh-huh.
Bob Lefsetz on his podcast, his only call to action. I can't figure out how that guy makes money.
Okay.
You're less probably in his world than I am, but I'm on his email list. I listen to his podcast, find the whole thing super fascinating. I have no idea how the dude makes money, but on his podcast, he's like, email me, tell me what you think about this episode. And that's his only call to action is just email me. Mm-hmm. And maybe I need to have that as a call to action on the Consulting Pipeline podcast.
Yeah. You know, I hear from people, starting to hear from them in my Facebook group, which was sort of launched as a companion to the podcast. Not exactly, but they were launched at the same time. I also hear from people regularly, both in my emails and on LinkedIn, that they listen to my podcast or offline. And occasionally I'm having a sales conversation with someone because they heard us on offline or they heard me on another podcast.
Now that happens all the time. Someone's like, blah, 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 want to do this thing that you charge money for. And the context is I first heard about you on your podcast. So I know that people are listening and this is not poor me. I love doing my podcast. I would do it anyway, even if very few people listen, but I just want to hear from my listeners more. So
well, the one thing I would say is, are you promoting your podcast through email?
Somewhat. Sporadically. It depends.
Like a specific podcast with a specific topic, you talk about that in the email and then send it out?
Yeah, yes. I have, but again, sporadically, not in a disciplined, regular fashion.
Well, so in my weekly newsletter, which I know is pure laziness in your estimation, it's not daily, but my weekly newsletter...
I'm dangerously close to quitting this podcast. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, man. And I just crossed this major threshold. So when I send my newsletter on Fridays, I'll put like my favorite audio, video, book of the week, different resources that I like or that I want to promote. And usually I want to promote them because I like them. If I put an episode of Offline or I put an episode of the Liston.io show, I'm much more likely to be engaged in a conversation about that than if I don't specifically mention it, right? So if I just say generally, hey, go listen to my podcast, that's not going to create as much conversation as, what do you think about the consultant's conundrum, which is one that I just recorded, and I'm guessing is going to get some people to respond.
There we go. Okay, I'm going to look at how you do it and probably imitate that.
I think you should do a call to action too, though, whatever you think that is.
Yeah.
And I think also, Philip, that is a perfect segue to whatever it is that you would like to promote today.
Okay, let me go second, because the thing I'm going to promote kind of sets us up for our episode today. You go, and then I'll follow.
Love that. Okay, so what I want to promote today is my private Facebook group. The reason I am creating yet another social media thing, and I'm sure you're wondering why, is that on LinkedIn, I'm really bound by the format. It's got to be short. It's got to have a little bit more mass appeal. I'm not going to really give you a deep look inside of my business there. It's just not the place for it because everything's public. And so in the Facebook group, it's a place where I can post much longer content, much more in-depth content. We can engage in a private conversation that only the group members will see. So I would love it if you want help building your consulting business, kind of like the stuff we talk about here on Offline, Philip. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, Offline could be promoted in that Facebook group. Aha.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in terms of longer form content, I did a talk locally here in Portland on how I'm using LinkedIn video to market my business. And I recorded a version of that talk and put the whole thing in Facebook. So that group is called Consulting Power Up. Consulting Power Up. It's a closed group. All you have to do is apply, and I promise you'll get in. Everybody gets an A in my class. So yeah, it's totally free, and I would love to see you there. Consulting Power Up, private Facebook group.
Grading on an extreme curve. I like it.
Yes, sir.
I want to call attention to this podcast that this guy Seth Godin does. Seth may or may not be familiar to folks out there. I wouldn't say he's an acquired taste. My experience with Seth Godin, who you can think of as an author or a thought leader or a lot of other things. He's sort of prolific. He's written a lot of books. And my experience was, it was like interesting at first, and then all of a sudden I was addicted to hearing from him. And he is one of the few people who has caused me to see the world differently, which is about the highest praise I think I can give anybody.
Yep.
So I think he's, you know, the real deal. He's legit. He has a podcast that is quite good called Akimbo, and that's what I want folks to check out today if they have never heard of it. Maybe they're already regular listeners like me. Akimbo.link, and I'm sure we can drop a link to that in the show notes.
Or if you just go to any podcast app that you used, it's Akimbo, A-K-I-M as in Mary, B-O.
Yeah, there you go. It's excellent. His podcasts are... they're not like produced quite like, you know, an NPR show, audio show would be, but they have a similar level of intention and planning. It's almost like he's reading out loud a chapter from a book.
Yes.
And they're just excellent. There's none of this making stuff up on the fly like we do on this podcast. So it comes out once a week. It's really good stuff.
I was very reluctant to record solo episodes for my podcast. Mm-hmm. And then two things happened. I heard the Mark Butler Show, which I think is pretty engaging for a single person.
Definitely.
And then I heard Seth Godin, and I was like, oh, okay, I could do this. I was totally encouraged after I heard their two shows. And I wanted to recommend two particular episodes of Akimbo, and then I'll let you talk.
Okay.
Episode 14, The Regular Kind, and also episode 17, Game Theory and the Infinite Game. Excellent, excellent episodes.
What's interesting and a little weird is that he's structured it according to seasons. And so the numbering is going to start over in the second season. He's already in the second season. There wasn't a gap, though, between the first and the second season.
Yeah.
I guess he's looking forward to the point where he might decide to not do it anymore or have a gap in between seasons. But I got to the last episode of the first season and I was like, oh boy, I'm settling in for a drought here. And then the next week there was the first episode of the second season.
Yeah, that I don't fully understand. Like, why break them into seasons but still produce a weekly podcast? That blew my mind too, but...
Right, and maybe it's just building in some flexibility for himself in the future. Anyway, I'm sure this is super interesting, not to our audience. The point is, those episodes are from the first season because the second season is not even, as we record this, we're at like the sixth or seventh episode, I think.
Yeah, and so speaking of Akimbo, juggling and bicycles, Philip?
Speaking of Akimbo, yeah. Listen and I both heard this particular episode, and I got really excited about it because this particular episode of this podcast, Akimbo, that we've been talking about, and it was exciting to me because it just relates so closely to what I have to do and have to break new ground in order to help my clients be successful. And so let me try to set this up. So if you look at episode 5 of season 2 of Akimbo, it's called Throw, Throw, Catch, Catch. And it's Seth Godin talking about this idea that there are building block skills that contribute to your success in some endeavor. And those building block skills are often a miniaturized version of the quote-unquote real thing. He talks about some form of soccer that's played maybe throughout all of South America or maybe just in Brazil. And it's like kid soccer, but it's not kids playing on a full-size soccer field. It's kids playing with a smaller ball and in a smaller area and with different rules than full-size soccer. And what they're doing is building transferable skills, but in a miniature sort of low-stakes setting. And there's no equivalent of that, as far as I'm aware of. Well, there is an equivalent of that in baseball. It's T-ball, right? Where instead of the pitcher throwing the ball and the batter trying to swing at a moving ball, the ball is set up on a little stand, right? So there is, in that sport, a miniaturized version of, but I don't think there's quite the same thing with basketball. You know a lot more about this than I do, Liston.
I'd probably be the resident sports guy, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
So, but am I right? Is there no sort of miniaturized version of basketball where you can learn the sort of core basic skills in a kind of low-stakes environment that's suitable for a child or a miniature human being?
So Seth talked about this on the podcast. They put a little fitting over the rim, and so it gives you like a 5-foot rim instead of a 10-foot rim.
Oh, okay. They do have that.
Yeah. So they have that, and the kids play with a smaller ball. And also, I was wondering, do we include practice in this? So in practice, where you're doing skills drills, like when I practiced in high school for basketball, rarely did we play a game in practice. It was always skills focused. We're just going to rebound. Now we're just going to do free throws. Now we're just going to do running, right? We looked at the individual components of what made a team better.
Right.
And then we tried to break those down and just focus on those. Does that count?
I think it counts in that it is taking something that's a part of this thing that we want to do,
yeah,
and pulling out building blocks of that thing. So yeah, I think that does count.
Yeah. And so I think about like the lean startup movement or like the sort of micropreneur kind of like crafty DIY kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like go sell your first $10 thing.
Right.
And that'll feel like a big win. And like, there's not much at stake for you to do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you sort of break it down.
Right. Yeah. I've seen Amy Hoy incorporate that idea into her 30 by 500 training program where
that's exactly. Yeah. I was thinking of that too.
It's been years now, I think, where she shifted the emphasis away from, oh, do the research and then build like a software product. That's what you might have seen participants in her program, I don't know, 5 years ago focusing on. And now she's saying, ship something like a $10 ebook or a PDF or
right.
some sort of informational resource that you sell where you're solving the problem in a kind of miniaturized way, at least compared to something complex like a piece of software. And I think it's for really good reasons. So Seth's description of this in this episode of Akimbo is much more nuanced than I've conveyed here, but that's okay. The idea is maybe for what you and I do, Liston, there are skill building blocks that we could talk about. They're miniaturized versions or skills that you can practice in a more low-stakes environment that prepare you for the thing that I'm hoping people will do, which is make a decision about how to specialize and then follow through on it and then start generating leads the way a specialist does, not the way a generalist would. And so that's what I'm going to talk about, and you're going to get the spotlight next week, and we're going to do the same thing with you and sales, right?
Yes, this is a two-parter.
It is. So that's the setup. And I actually did my homework for this episode, so I'm not just winging it. I actually have some ideas about four things that to me are preparing for or practicing for or doing skill building for this idea that you're going to specialize. And then based on this specialization, you're going to develop a market position that helps your business, helps you get premium rates, helps you accumulate valuable expertise. What do you think the first thing I'm going to say is, Liston, for the first of these four skill building blocks? Do you have a guess?
Well, I can see them in Asana. Are they not in the right order?
Damn it. Never mind. The first one.
Well, hold on. I would have taken a guess, and my guess would not have been the first thing on here.
Let me reframe it. Are you surprised by what I put in there?
Slightly. I think what I would have said is getting clear on who you want to serve and then starting to draw some boundaries, which may cost you money. And you said something like that.
That's way too advanced.
Okay.
Meaning that's actually the process. So that's like adult basketball. That's like adult soccer. That's the grown-up version. And so I'm trying to think, well, what do you do the year or two before you do that? What do you start practicing in miniature? So you're wrong and I'm right. No, I'm just kidding. But
I'm used to
what
it.
I'm saying is I'm thinking more simply, more basically. So the first thing is I think you can start saying no in small ways to clients. And not capriciously, not for the sake of saying no, but because I am, like, I don't just think this, I know this from personal experience, and maybe this is a little bit colored by my own experience, but it was very hard for me to say no to clients earlier in my career. I felt like those client relationships were rare and hard to come by, which was kind of true because I sucked at business development back then. And so I felt like I needed to bend over backwards to protect them, which meant that the word N-O was actually a little bit scary for me to say that, even if I felt like there was a good reason. Because in the way I saw things back then, which was a distorted way of seeing things, but the way I saw things was, that gives the client a reason to fire me, or that threatens this relationship if I say no. So this starts getting into, like, again, some people have no problem saying no. Maybe they love it. I've heard in books I've read since then on negotiation that that puts us in a position of safety if we feel like we can say no, because it feels like, oh, we're protecting ourselves against somebody's demands or outside influence or whatever. So it feels like a safe place to be able to say no. But unlike that, years ago in my career, it felt threatening to say no.
Would you say, Philip, that your personality is very high in agreeableness, which is one of the dimensions of personality?
It's getting less so. Like, I'm getting less agreeable as I mature. But that's a good thing because the starting point for me was too agreeable.
Right. And so that's what I was trying to get to. Do you think that there was sort of an innate tendency for you personally to make it really difficult to say no?
Oh, yeah. And this gets way into, like, your personality, who you are as a person.
Yeah.
I definitely have a history as a people pleaser, which is another way, another lens to put on that, where the idea is that your value is sort of fitting other people's agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, it definitely has roots in my personality, my unique beauty and flawedness as a person.
And so how are you able to break down the problem into lower stakes to actually be able to say no in a small way?
It always kind of starts with some sort of awareness. So the first awareness for me was every client relationship that ended up causing me pain, I realized I had seen signs before the relationship became formalized with money changing hands.
Yep.
So that was the first awareness for me, was like, oh, wait, none of this stuff came out of nowhere. There were always warning signs. This client that maybe the pain was the client was not great at communication, or maybe more accurately, we were not great at communication. And that never started after the project started. It started before. The signs were there. So that was the first thing, was to realize that the signs were always there. And then the next thing I did was put together a spreadsheet where I listed out every red flag I'd ever seen and then forced myself to start filling it out for prospective clients. And I actually set up a little formula. So if it was like a yes, no thing, so I'd put a one for a yes and a zero for a no next to all these items on the spreadsheet. And if it got a zero, it would turn that cell red because that was a red flag that this is a potential future problem in this client relationship. So that's one of the first things I started doing. And then I can't remember the exact time, but there was a moment when I said, I don't think this is a good fit to a potential client for the first time. And again, I hope that nobody else out there has this problem, but I know that's not true. I know that others do have this problem. And so you're not saying no capriciously. You are at some point going to culminate in passing on an opportunity And this, again, is skill building for the discipline that you'll need in order to specialize. So at some point, you're going to say, yeah, I could do this, but it's not a good fit or it's not an ideal fit. And it's, of course, it's easy to pass on the horribly bad fit prospects. But at some point, I see folks practicing saying no, and then that culminates in them saying no to something that is an opportunity, but it's not a good one. It's not an ideal opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first skill building block. I'm curious about you, listener. Have you ever had trouble saying no? Or has that always been relatively easy for you?
No, it hasn't always been easy. I'd say my personality is not one that rates high in agreeableness. So that component of it is not something that has ever affected me. However, I would say that when I was just getting started and I didn't have this mindset of like, oh, there are millions of people I could go help right now. It's just a matter of finding them.
Yeah.
When it felt like so daunting and truthfully like nearly impossible that I would get any more work,
That
makes it really, really hard to say no. That's the natural tendency of a lot of consulting businesses is you start to stretch yourself into other areas because you're responding to the demands of other people rather than saying like, no, these are my boundaries and I do my best work here. And so I'm not going to leave this area.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was very, very, very difficult because I didn't know if I would get another contract ever or if I could trick, quote unquote, or convince someone else to work with me because I just didn't have the data yet. Like I was so new to it that it was hard to imagine that it would be anything but difficult moving forward.
What's interesting to me about that is that you and I have quite different personalities. But what caused the behavior was essentially the same thing, which was this perception that opportunity is rare and perhaps difficult to obtain.
Right. If you are, I don't want to say lucky, but gifted enough to figure out a way to bring 50 leads into your business tomorrow, you'll never worry about saying no, right? You have a lot of freedom and latitude to just go, you know what, I'm going to try something new tomorrow. And it really doesn't matter if no one likes it.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to not hoard something that's in abundant supply.
Yep.
So that's my first kind of halting myself for a second here. I did a podcast this week on the Consulting Pipeline podcast. I released an episode about the minimum effective dose of change. And that's also part of the thinking here is like, what are little things that you can do that are changes in behavior? And change is not easy. I do know some people who crave change, who love it. But I think for most people, change is something they tend to, they want to manage it or resist it. I'm not sure the majority of people embrace change. I think if they did, our country would be quite, like politics in this country would be quite different.
Well, it's not just our country, but if you just look at the events that are most stressful for people, changing jobs, moving, marriage, divorce, like all these significant life changes, those are the times where people feel the most stressed.
Yeah.
So
you're right.
It is more common than not. And the reason is change signifies to us that our world is ending. The world as we knew it no longer exists. And that's freaking scary.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, you're most people feel that way. That's a long way of saying it.
Yeah. I think we're safe saying most people are threatened at some level by change. It might be just
incredibly safe saying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where the hell was I going with that? Listen, I just lost my train of thought. I got so fascinated. Thinking,
were you moving on to point number two?
I don't know. Oh, well, point two is, oh, it was a minimum effective dose thing. It's like change. I think if you have too much change that you're bringing on yourself, I'm not sure that's a sustainable path for very long. That was my point, is all these sort of four things I'm going to go through are under the umbrella of what can you do gradually? What can you do incrementally? What can you do in small quantities that will be a part of taking you where you want to go, but they're not a threatening amount of change, hopefully, or they're not an overwhelming amount of change. Mm-hmm. There we go. That's what I was going to try to say. So my second suggestion is have a business conversation or learn something outside the scope of your work with a client about how that client makes or loses money. Pretty simple.
Why is that important to positioning?
There's a bit of an assumption here. So In terms of specializing or developing a reputation for something, one option is, you know, one road that was available to you, Liston, was to, I'm trying to make you laugh with this on purpose.
Okay, I'm ready.
One specialization option that at one point was available to you when you were a HubSpot agency, meaning you were a reseller of HubSpot and you provided sort of implementation services around HubSpot. One option that you could have pursued was to try to become essentially world famous for that and just be like famous for or well known or have a reputation for, boy, if you're going to use HubSpot, you really got to hire this Liston guy. He really knows how to make that software do what it's supposed to do.
Yes, because it's the best software ever.
Well, that was an option that was available to you. And if you're going to pursue that, then you may not need to really know that much about how a manufacturing business works, or you may not need to know how a hospital works. But if you're going to specialize in a way that I think is more suitable for most people, then you're going to specialize in a vertical or a type of business problem. And if you're anything like I was starting out, I mean, you understand that businesses need to make more money than they spend, yada, yada, yada. You understand that that's how businesses, quote unquote, work. But do you understand, if you're working with hospitals, what kind of regulation they're concerned about? Do you understand how they measure the profitability of various services? Do you understand, in their marketing, what they think moves the needle in terms of attracting more people? Do you understand how they are contractually interacting with doctors and surgeons and nurses and all the humans that work in a hospital? Do you understand what makes that business tick? And I think understanding that at an intermediate level, not a deep level, I tell people, if the CEO of your client gets hit by a bus, they're not going to ask you to step in and take over for the CEO. You don't need to understand the business at that level. But understanding it beyond the superficial level, I think is important, and I think it's an aspect of specializing. And so I think you can start practicing that by, if all you do is code, or all you do is write marketing content, or all you do is design, or all you do for a client is whatever, step outside the scope of that intentionally and find out something about how the business works. It's simple. I think it's relatively low stakes. It may feel a little bit uncomfortable at first. That's my second suggestion for a skill building block. And I'm curious what you think about that, Liston.
First of all, I think it's essential. It's interesting. Like when I was doing copywriting and digital marketing, I would ask questions like, so what's your monthly revenue? How do you acquire clients? And people are like, why does this matter for copy? And I'm like, well, you want to hire someone to help you build your business. Like, shouldn't I understand how your business works? Mm-hmm. I thought it was just so interesting that people had such a narrow view. And I find it's also true for a lot of consultants. They feel like they don't need to know all the ins and outs of how the business works. However, the amount of insight that you'll gain from that and the amount of leverage that it gives you in building your business, making decisions about products and service lines you have, all those things, I think is essential. I guess I was wondering though, how would you tie learning more about your clients' businesses and how they make and lose money? How would you tie that directly to positioning though?
Well, because at some point, it has sort of two endpoints. If you think of this as a path you start down, it has two endpoints. One is it starts practicing the skills you'll need for value pricing, which is not related directly to positioning. But at some point on the expertise spectrum of building valuable expertise, you start to have to understand how to apply your technical skills in a more effective way. And that's where it starts relating to positioning. In other words, maybe your goal is to be the world's best HubSpot agency. If that's the case, your focus is really on the sort of technical skills around HubSpot, I think. But if you can start to understand how to use your technical skills to move the needle for a business, then that's where you need to understand how the business works. I'll put it in an example that's specific to you, Liston. So if you thought about sales as achieving a high close rate And if that seemed to be the end point of sales, you would take, I think, a very different approach to it than you do. But you understand that sales is in a larger context. And so for some businesses, it's about understanding what kind of client is going to be a low margin client for them or lose them money. And that's where I think you have to understand how the business works in order to really be great at what you do. Even though what you do is sales, it's this one component. It's understanding the larger business context that helps you be more valuable in applying your technical skills.
Yeah, that's true. So part of my insight, which is also part of my positioning, is essentially selling as a consultant is different because the nature of our relationships is different, and that should affect the things you do think and say along the way.
Right. And, you know, if you got, this would never happen, but let's say that someone drugged you and you had a sales conversation with a prospect who is running like a telemarketing phone bank, and you said, yeah, I'll help you with your sales. And all of a sudden you're now in this project where maybe you know a little bit about how telemarketing works, but every piece of advice that you give them is contextually inappropriate for what they're trying to do. Because you're giving advice for people who the value of each individual relationship is very high. On that phone bank, it's the opposite. The value of each sale is very low. And just so everything about what you tell them is out of context. And that's really what I'm saying is that all of our skills, whatever they are, in the right context, and when we're aware of the context, those skills create more value if we have that contextual awareness. And the context is the business that you apply them to.
I definitely agree.
All right. Darn it. Okay, I'm looking for some disagreement here. Third suggestion, build an outbound marketing list.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with you on this one. Go ahead. Why should we do that?
Because it'll teach you about, okay, I'm assuming that someone's never done this before.
Okay, first of all, what is an outbound marketing list?
It's a list of people that you would reach out to with cold email.
For what purpose?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
In the context of what I'm saying, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
So this is going to be for someone who's never done this, which is going to be me 5 years ago, or I think lots of people that I've worked with have never done this. And so the first time they do this, it raises all these questions. It sounds very simple. Build me a list of 100 people who would be good prospective clients for your business. And if you've never done that before, you're like, oh, okay, I guess I can do that. I'll go to LinkedIn and I'll start building my list.
Yeah, I'll search for business owners who have the budget to pay me.
Right, who are fun to work with, who never question my input. I feel like we've had this conversation before, right?
Yes, and their values are totally aligned with mine.
Right, and their ambitious growing businesses.
Yes.
They're growth oriented. They want to invest. They see the value of investing in whatever it is I do. It becomes real hard real fast. Because there's all these this work you haven't done to figure out who's a good prospect and who's a fit. And so what I'm saying is the value of this is not the list that you build. The value is having to think about those questions that maybe you've never thought about before. Because if all your business has found you through referrals and repeat business, then it's likely you've not thought deeply about what kind of client you want to find. Or if you have thought about it, you've thought about it in the way that Liston and I were just joking about, which is, oh, I just want clients who value what I do and they pay their invoices on time and blah, blah, blah. And you just go down this list of qualities that you could never do a search for on LinkedIn, never in a million years. So that to me is the value of this as a building block, is it forces you to ask questions that you will not have easy, immediate answers for. Those questions will haunt you. They will maybe keep you up at night. They will make you not happy with the way things are. And that will move your business forward, I believe. Now, were you really disagreeing, Liston, or were you just doing that for fun?
Maybe a little bit of both.
Okay, well, tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah, so I think that choosing an ideal client that you can identify based on publicly available data is something that every business needs to do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, with your urging, Philip, at the start of the year, that's exactly what I did with my current business. And I mean, the results have been amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just totally blown away by the level of interest.
Where's my commission check for that?
This is it. This is your payment. Okay. You get to do offline with me.
I get to do a podcast with you. Okay. All right. Fair enough. I'll take it.
On the other hand, what I don't want people to do is get bogged down into using the list. What do I do with it? What do I say?
You throw it away when you're done.
The main reason I don't think that that is a vital part of it, using the list is not a vital part of it, yeah, is the amount of outreach in most cases, in most markets, and different markets are have different response rates, but in most cases, it's such a numbers game that you're not going to be able to get satisfactory results unless you do a lot of it. And I think that that can be a very discouraging thing for a lot of people. And so I wouldn't want you to get stuck on that part of it. Part of it is, I would say it's not you, it's them. It's just like people are being
inundated,
bugged all the time. Yeah, inundated. They're being interrupted constantly. Yeah. So that's a big part of it. And I just wouldn't want someone to kind of stop the exercise because they go, well, I built this list and then I tried to contact these people and it didn't really do anything for me. This shit doesn't work. And that shouldn't be the conclusion.
Yeah, you bring up so many good points there. And to clarify this, I would say if you are thinking about actually doing some of these things I suggest, I hope you are, if it's appropriate for where you're at in your business, you're not going to email this list or call anybody or contact anybody on this list. And so the list building doesn't have to be hundreds and hundreds, which, as Liston pointed out, if you actually were going to do outbound marketing, you'd want to be contacting hundreds of prospective clients at a minimum.
Right.
You're not going to do that. So the list building could be just try to get to 30. I dare you to try to get to 30. It's a miniature thing. Because the real value is it creates all these questions that you don't have answers for. But if you can answer them, it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. The other thing is write the emails that you would send this list, but don't send those emails. It'll do the same thing. It'll create even more questions that you may not have an answer for, but if you could answer them, it would be great. Like, what do you say if you're going to email somebody out of the blue and have any hope at all of them being interested in responding to you? What do you say? It better be good. It better be about value, or it better be about their world, or it better be about a problem that they are experiencing if you want even a snowball's chance in hell of them responding.
Right. Agreed.
It can't be where I hate that so many of these types of messages seem to come from Indian companies because it makes me feel like I'm being anti-Indian company, but I can't help but point out that so much of the kind of spammy, crappy outreach emails that I get seem to be from Indian companies. And they're like, we noticed that your website isn't ranking well and it doesn't target something that I care about. Anyway.
Yes.
I'm glad you put those caveats on that item, Liston. I agree with everything you said. You're not going to email this list, but you're going to stop just short of emailing them because all the activities you do to get to that point are going to bring up uncomfortable questions that will take some time to answer. And that's the point of this exercise, is to raise those questions.
Perfect. We've come full circle. I think we're back to agreement.
All right. Our natural state. It's nodding and agreeing with each other.
Well, Philip, I hate change, so I wouldn't want to be living in a state of disagreement.
Ah, welcome to the club. So, fourth thing, if you have a few clients in the same vertical, let me expand on that a little bit. If you are where you are today in your business and you look back at all the clients you've worked with and you have a few clients that are similar to each other, meaning they do the same kind of business, a few clients in manufacturing, a few clients in finance, a few clients in healthcare, whatever it is, then write down every advantage that you have when you work with that kind of client that you lack if you were to work with a type of client that you've never worked with before.
Mm-hmm.
This may be as transparently obvious what the goal here is, but the goal is to get you thinking about the head start that you have when you work with a client that is similar to a previous client you've worked with before. I'm thinking more about the clients are in the same industry, the same vertical, not that they're both small businesses or not that they're both publicly held companies or whatever, because that's too much potential diversity. So I'm saying, let's say you've had three clients in manufacturing and one client in healthcare and one client in finance and one client in janitorial services. What do you notice when you work with those three clients in manufacturing? What head start do you have with them? So this is just an exercise that's kind of self-reflection to see if you notice that maybe you have an easier time communicating with those clients in manufacturing. Maybe you understand what they mean when they talk about mean time before failure or some other term of art that's particular to their industry. Just notice those things. That's all. That's all I'm asking. Very simple. And this perhaps is the lowest stakes one because it's you and a sheet of paper. You don't have to talk to anybody. You don't have to do much work other than a bit of thinking and sort of journaling, if you will. It's very low stakes.
I just wanted to follow up on what you said about we're not going to allow you to say small business is your vertical. I think I was listening to Two Bobs, and I think Blair mentioned that some people say, well, we help B2B companies do XYZ, improve their marketing.
Right.
And he made the point that B2B businesses are responsible for something like 70% of all economic activity, which seemed actually too high to me. But anyway, the point is taken.
Yeah.
It's insufficient in terms of positioning. Just so you know, dear listener, the number of small businesses in the United States alone is 28 million as of 2010. So we definitely like to get a lot more specific than that.
Yeah, there's something like over 30 million businesses total in the U.S. And I'm like, it's just unimaginably large as a market.
All right. Can we limit our market to 1 million people even? Like that would be a huge win.
Yeah. I mean, and that's not actually small enough, but that's getting closer than 30 million. That's for sure.
What do you say as the back of the napkin is the right market size for most people?
I just use David C. Baker's numbers, 10,000 prospective clients at the top end. So that's pretty easy. You're going to go to the NAICS website. You're going to see how many companies are in that vertical. That's going to be a starting point. And then you're going to acknowledge that some of them are too small to afford you and some of them are too big to take you seriously. So you're going to cut that down to based on things like revenue numbers or employee headcount. And you're going to get that somewhat painfully by using the American Fact Finder, which is this data portal that the U.S. Census Bureau provides. And if you're not in the U.S., you're going to use those U.S. numbers anyway because they'll probably map pretty well to where you are.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is find right-sized companies, meaning not too big to take you seriously, not too small to afford you. And that segment of the market is going to need to be between 1,000, 2,000 on the low end and 10,000 on the upper end.
Interesting. I think that sounds too small, but all right.
There's other factors too. If you want to sell a book, all these things are out the window. This is for services.
Right. This is for high ticket
services. Yep.
Got it.
I mean, there's some assumptions baked into this, like what we just mentioned. You want to sell a book or you want to sell widgets. It's a whole different ballgame.
Yes, sir. Well, I think it's worth mentioning.
Yep. So what do you think of my list?
I think it's solid. And you know what I like about it, especially, is that I think it's reasonable to say that anybody could do this in an hour or two. It's not that difficult.
Yeah, some of the things are pretty quick. Some might take a little longer, like finding that opportunity to say no in the right way, not just arbitrarily say no, but yeah.
Well, in one way you could approach that. One thing I would suggest anybody listening to this is to say like, oh, this thing that I hate doing, it keeps coming up with potential clients. Next time it comes up, I'm just going to say no to that, right?
Listen, you're so good at finding the diplomatic way to say, but the straightforward diplomatic way to. So how would you suggest people say no to something a client's been asking them to do? They don't want to do it. They know it's, you know, reasonable to say no. How do you say no the first time? I know I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, it really depends on what it is. Usually the way I would say it is just, I totally understand why that's an important thing for you to have happen for your company. I'm not the best person suited for that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like a referral? Something like that. Yeah. It's great if you can still help them through a referral. If not, you can just say, you know, that's not something that I can do for you, mm-hmm. unfortunately. If you want some ideas on how we could approach it, I'd be happy to have that conversation. And usually people will say yes.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Did we do it, Philip?
I feel like I'm standing on a battleship with a big mission accomplished flag behind me. Yeah, I think we did it.
Awesome. Are you wearing an official Air Force outfit?
I don't have that.
Oh, okay.
Part of the whole thing, but
well,
yeah.
Well, you're no George W., that's for sure.
Mm-mm. We did it.
All right, my friend. I will see you soon.
You're up next.
Yes. Next time, tune in, and I'm going to tell you the foundational skills that you should be practicing to get better at sales.
I can't wait. I can't wait to put you on the spot with that.
You'll see what my mini hoop looks like next week.
Nice. Good talking to you, Liston.
All right. Bye, Philip.
Bye.